The Womanity Project. Let's talk about gender. Genders. Gender? Gender equality. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Womanity Project Live. I'm Aurélie Harp.
And I'm Celine Rosenthal, and you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn.
According to the FBI, anti-Muslim hate crimes are approximately 5 times more frequent than they were before September 11, 2001. The past year has been particularly brutal, especially in the aftermath of Islamic State-claimed attacks in Europe and the San Bernardino shooting last December, carried out by a Muslim husband and wife.
Anti-Muslim rhetoric has been given an enormous boost of pseudo-credibility and prominence by Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump.
Islamophobia is not new and also present in the liberal atheist mainstream. What we hear is that extremism and intolerance are problems that afflict Muslim at large and that women are treated at best like second-class citizens, but most often like property in Islam.
So, we wanted to have a conversation about Islam and what it says pertaining to women and how it is to be a Muslim woman. So, today, we have the honor to interview Maryam Arachi Ney Husseini, a paramedic, wife, mother, and Muslim.
Growing up, Maryam attended an Islamist school here in Brooklyn, New York. Let's hear what she has to say about her childhood, her education, and her life as a Muslim woman.
What's your name?
My name is Maryam.
What's your full name?
Oh, Maryam Moin Arachi.
Our first question is, where did your name come from?
My name, Maryam, is actually from the Quran, which is the name for Jesus' mom.
Mm-hmm.
And in Arabic, it's Maryam.
Nice.
And Jesus in Arabic is actually Isa. So my name is Maryam from the Quran.
Very nice. And where are you from?
I'm from Pakistan and India. My dad was born and raised in India. My mom was born and raised in Pakistan. My grandfather migrated from India actually during the divide.
Ooh.
And he actually ended up in Karachi, mm-hmm. Which is in the south of Pakistan, and that's where he raised his family.
Very cool. Where were you born, though?
I was born in Pakistan, too.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
I didn't even know that.
I was born in Pakistan in 1984, mm-hmm. But I didn't live there. My mom brought me to America when I was only 40 days old.
Oh, wow. And when you first came to the U.S., where did you move to?
We lived in Queens for about 3 years before we moved to Brooklyn.
All right.
Yeah, I lived in Starrett City.
I didn't know that. That's very cool. And do you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have one sister and 2 brothers. I'm the oldest. Mm-hmm. And my sister was born here, so are my brothers. I was the only one that was born in Pakistan.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school in PS 346 in Brooklyn.
Nice.
And then I went to junior high in El Noor School. And then I went to high school in Al Iman School. They're both private Islamic schools.
There are an estimated 240 to 250 private Islamic schools in the U.S. offering instruction to K-12 students. The Islamic School League of America, ISLA, a nonprofit that connects Muslims educators and institutions, estimates that 40,000 students are enrolled in Islamic schools in the United States, a 25% increase from 2006. Those numbers are expected to keep growing as new schools open and existing schools are continuing.
The increased enrollment in these schools reflects the religion's growing number of American followers and the desire of parents to shelter Muslims from the discrimination and discomfort they might encounter at public schools.
Let's hear how Maryam describes her experience in her Islamic school.
So what's that like? What's a private Islamic school like?
It's different because the classes are very small, so you know your entire class.
Mm-hmm.
12th grade was only 8 people.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was 11th grade, so it was 10th grade, so it was 9th grade. So
that
I basically,
is super small.
Yes,
all
I right. basically went to school with the same people for my entire high school. And we all came back every year, and we were all still the same people every year.
So what are the differences between, I guess, what we would consider a standard public school education and being in an Islamic school?
I would say that because a lot of Islamic schools don't have a lot of resources that public schools do, or even like public, I'm going to say you know, the higher education schools like Stuyvesant or Brooklyn Tech, we did not have such great teachers, or we didn't have the resources to actually get our kids into many programs or anything. And, you know, we weren't recognized as, like, you know, as Stuyvesant students would be or Brooklyn Tech students would be. And even though we had very highly intelligent, very intellectual, very promising students, you know, they wouldn't be looked at as highly as other school students would be. So that was one of the setbacks. However, there was a lot of teachers that were very dedicated, very, very dedicated to their students, because they've seen them grow. They've seen them grow since they started the school.
Wow.
And a lot of them came into the school when it had first started, which was like when they were in like third or fourth grade, and they actually had the same teachers and the same guidance counselors all through their life. So these people were very dedicated to their students. They were like children to them.
And what subjects would you study?
We studied the same thing as any other standard school. We did English and math, and we did two languages, because Arabic was one of the required languages for the school, and Spanish was another required language as part of the regents. Mm-hmm. And we did global history, U.S. government. We did, what else, literature. We did reading. Anything else that any other standard school were required by the state, we did those along with Arabic and Quran and Islamic studies.
So during your school day, then, did they have time to pray?
Yes.
Did you pray during school?
We actually did. We actually had a specific time allotted to pray. We had prayer time at 1 o'clock, mm-hmm. so it actually kind of coincided with our lunchtime. So we would have lunch. Right after lunch, it would be prayer time. So 1 hour was allotted during the school day for prayer.
According to an article in NBC News in 2011, Islamic schools in the rise in the U.S. struggle for recognition. And like mosques and other Islamic institutions, can be viewed with distrust and even hostility, which means the founders have to work overtime to gain a foothold in many communities.
It's interesting. The same questioning doesn't seem to apply for Jewish or Catholic private schools. Mm. But let's continue our conversation.
And was the school kind of separated into boys and girls?
It was kind of separated. It was. Basically, the boys would sit to the back of the class. That was separation. And you would line up separate from the boys. So the girls would have one side of the auditorium, and the boys would have one side of the auditorium when you lined up. Mm-hmm. However, when you went to class, the boys would sit at the back of the room and the girls would sit at the front.
Okay. Very nice that the girls get to sit in the front.
Yes. Well, they're kind of shorter, so it doesn't help if the guys are taller. You can't really see.
Gotcha. Was there a school uniform at all?
Yes. When I first initially started, it was a very ugly looking thing. It was what's called an abaya, mm-hmm. and it's just a very long dress from your neck to your feet, and it was buttoned down, and it was gray. It's like a very drab, haggard-looking thing. It was very ugly. So come in 10th grade, I was in 10th grade, we actually commissioned the school. We had a petition put together, and a lot of the students spoke out, and they asked for like the what we consider the student government to speak on behalf of the students that we wanted to redo the uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And the principal asked us, okay, well, what would you do as the new uniform? And we said, well, we could do something that's similar, but it looks a little better. So mm-hmm. we ended up with a long, loose white shirt that's mm-hmm. mid-thigh mm-hmm. and a long black skirt up to your ankle with black shoes, black socks, and a black hijab.
What did the boys wear?
They had a very standard uniform, which was also navy blue pants, mm-hmm. light blue shirt, and a navy blue sweater vest with a tie, with a navy blue tie.
What, did you have gym classes?
Yes,
too?
We did.
What was gym like then? Because were you observing rules about not being able to touch?
We had separate gym classes. Boys were separate and girls were separate. We had a separate area for it. Boys were in a separate area and girls were in a separate area. And it was the only time we were able to take our hijab off to play, because no boys were allowed into the area at all. So we played basketball, we played badminton, we played volleyball, we did a little running. That's pretty much it.
That's awesome. So at what age did you start wearing hijab to school? Or did you wear hijab?
Actually, I just wore hijab because I was going to an Islamic school and it was required. So since 7th grade, I was wearing hijab. And then I wore it all through, and I wore it outside of school too, because I was just used to it. It was a part of me. And then when I started college, I was still wearing hijab. And then when I started coming to the end of college is when I stopped wearing it. I was wearing it here and there. It was still 75%, but 25% I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And then when I came back to New York, I went to college in upstate. So when I came back to New York, I started not wearing it as much. And then it kind of just completely went away when I was like 23 years old.
Mariam started wearing the hijab again after she got married. She explained to us why it is important for her and her baby daughter.
I wear it because it's a part of me. I want it to be a part of me. I feel beautiful in it. And it's something that I do because I want to do it, not because somebody's telling me to do it. Me being a female, especially in Islam, is such a huge thing because women in Islam have so many rights, and they're basically treated like queens, like true people who practice the religion properly, who know the rights of women and who don't try to trample those rights, who don't try to bring some sort of masculine laws or anything like that into it, know how precious and beautiful and empowered women are in Islam. So another thing, like, especially with my daughter, as she grows older, that's something I want to do for her, was I want her to understand how important she is as a female figure in Islam. So as she gets older, I want her to understand about her hijab, which is the traditional covering that women wear, and I want to give her a hijab party. Mm-hmm. And why is because I want her to love her hijab. I want her to admire it. I want her to feel beautiful in it. I want her to wear it because she wants to, because she feels that it's a part of her. And not with all these negative ideas that people have in media and in culture, that it's such a negative thing, that women are oppressed or that it's negatively impacts them. No, but you have to understand that hijab, a lot of women wear it because it's a part of them.
The debate around the hijab has always been controversial, especially in countries like France, where feminism goes with secularism, and where the hijab is considered as a first step against women's emancipation, which explains why France bites so vividly the burqa too.
The headscarf was banned in 2004 in France, and the burqa in 2010. The key argument supporting the ban is that face coverings prevent the clear identification of a person, which is both a risk to security and a social hindrance within society, which relies on facial recognition and expression for communication. The key argument against the ban is that it encroaches on the individual's freedom. The law was changed and was taken to the European Court of Human Rights, which upheld the French law on the 1st of July in 2014, accepting the argument of the French government that the law was based on a, quote, certain idea of living together. But the polemic is still very strong. Orly, can you tell us more about this burkini incident?
Oh, yeah. Well, this summer, the burkini was making the headlines, right? That was the most important news in France. It all started with the brand Ahida, created by the Australo-Lebanon Ahida Zanetti, who created the head-to-toe swimming suit for women in 2004. Once designed for markets in the Middle East, such clothing is now gaining mainstream appeal in the West. And in stores across Europe, Islamic fashion is now becoming available for top designers such as Dolce & Gabbana, DKNY, but also Marks & Spencer and Uniqlo. And I didn't know that, but worldwide, Muslim consumers spent over $266 billion. They spent that in 2013.
Wow.
Yeah. So now, the burkini is by essence not illegal. However, some municipalities in France decided to ban the swimsuit from the beaches. And how can I say that? The debate is very complicated. On one side, the feminist and very respected philosopher Elisabeth Badinter, which I really, truly respect, called for a boycott of brands selling Islamic fashion. And even the Paris mayor, Anne Hidalgo, said she found the trend a little upsetting. Which you can see why, you know, with the feminism tradition in France of women being free to wear what they want and so on. But on the other side, you can hear the French journalist and Muslim, Faiza Zerouala, who is the author of the book Voices Behind the Veil, who says that secularism is being used today as a shield against Islam. It's unacceptable to say you're anti-Muslim, but it's okay to say you're fighting to defend secularism. And I think she got a point.
Yeah, I mean, shouldn't people be able to dress the way that they want to dress and the way that they feel comfortable? Isn't that kind of the definition of freedom?
You're right. And at the same time, I'm very honest with you. Because I'm French, I see the point as well of not being able to see a face can be a problem. It's so complicated.
Mm. And with Europe's largest Muslim population, France is struggling to balance tolerance, secularism, and personal freedom in a climate of heightened fear and security following these two terrorist attacks last year. A state of emergency has been in place since November. We're going to take a little break. And in the meantime, we're going to leave you with one of Miriam's power songs. This is Sanam Hoja by Arjun.
Listening to the Womanity Project on Radio Free Brooklyn.
So, Miriam described how Islam considers women as queens, And she and her husband are now going to tell us a little bit more about he converted to Islam and about their wedding ceremony.
And your husband, is he Muslim?
He is actually Muslim, yes. He is Dominican. He was not Muslim before. He was Christian. He wasn't a much practicing Christian, but he was still Christian. He was baptized and everything. So, once we met, I told him a little bit about my religion, because even though I wasn't a practicing Muslim then, I still had a very strong faith. Like, I believe, like, God and faith was a huge part of my life. And I told him about this. And one of my partners actually mentioned to me, he's like, you know, your faith is so amazing. It's like an aura around you. Like, you know, he didn't see me as a practicing Muslim, but he still saw, like, how much my faith was a huge integral part of me. So I told my husband about my faith. And after I described to him a lot of the things about Islam, he felt like he had found his place. Like, he felt that he had been looking for something, and he found what he had been searching for his whole life. He felt like this is where he belonged. So he actually became Muslim. So there's actually five pillars in Islam. There's Shahada, which is the first pillar, and that's actually how you convert. So Shahada is when you testify that there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad, peace be upon him, is his messenger. And the conversion is actually very simple. You basically go into a mosque. You don't even have to go into a masjid or a mosque, which is what we call a mosque, which is a masjid. And and you'd only need a few witnesses, but there was hundreds because there was a lot of people there.
Because it was Maghrib prayer.
It was Maghrib prayer, which is a time for prayer. And my whole family was there. And all he had to say was a shahada, and that's it. He was Muslim. He just had to show his belief, and he has to testify, and that's pretty much it. However, there's four more pillars to Islam. There's prayer, which is salat, and you have to pray. And he learned all the prayer. Then there's zakat, which is charity. So you give charity every year. And then there's fasting, which is Sawm. And you fast during Ramadan every year. Ramadan just passed a few months ago. And then there's Hajj, where you make the pilgrimage once in your lifetime to Mecca. And that's the five pillars of Islam.
When someone converts to Islam, so there's a lot of misconceptions that you have to say the Shahada. So apparently, I was told that you have to say it in Arabic. So I practiced for a really, really long time to say it in Arabic. So when I actually went and took my Shahada, the guy actually said it in English, and I'm like, I didn't know it by heart in Arabic, but I forgot how to say it, so I had to, like, walk through it. But anyways, another part is the five pillars is the zakat. So she didn't really specify the zakat is 2.5% of your total worth, meaning, like, property, money, stocks, whatever. Mm-hmm. So 2.5% of that is what you give away to charity. Ah. And prayer. That's about everything I wanted to add about that.
Awesome. And so what was your wedding like?
Wedding was actually pretty simple. I know that there's a lot of ritualistic things in other religions where, you know, you say your vows in front of a priest for Christians, or I know in the Jewish culture, there's the candle. Yeah, you step on a glass. In the Muslim religion, actually, the most important aspect of a wedding comes from the girl. She has to accept the wedding before even a guy. Mm-hmm. So this is what the whole empowering women in Islam is about. So women in Islam have a lot of rights. And one of their main rights is being able to accept a groom or a man to marry. So the girl is asked first if she wants to marry this man. And she's asked three times, three separate questions. And she has to say yes to each separate question before the same thing is asked of the groom. So once she says yes and she signs the documents to marry a man, which also she has to agree to a dowry, which is hers and hers alone. Nobody can touch her dowry. So basically, her husband has to agree to give her a dowry of a set amount that she agreed to. It doesn't have to be even money. It could be anything that she wants. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some people have asked for something as simple as a Quran, or some people have asked for property, or some people, you know, it's not just about marrying, but that's her dowry, and that's her property, and nobody else, not even her husband, can touch it, and he's required by Islamic law to give it to her. So people have a misconception that a dowry is some sort of payment to the girl's family, but it's not. It's actually hers and hers alone. So once that's agreed upon and she's told and then she says yes, then you go to the groom and you ask him three times and then he signs the documents and then there's a sermon given about the blessings of the marriage and the marriage is blessed and then you're married. It's very simple.
Awesome.
The girl is asked first if she wants to marry the man and she's asked three times. Wow, I didn't know that. A lot to think about.
A lot to think about, right?
So our question to you this week, and for the ones who got married, can you share your story with us?
Any fun traditions or ceremonies that took place as part of your wedding? You have been listening to The Womanity Project on Radio Free Brooklyn. You can like us and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Womanity Project. You can support us and sponsor us on our page, radiofreebrooklyn.com/show/the-womanity-project. Special thanks to Miriam, my girl, and to her family for hosting me in their home all afternoon. Thank you to Lizzie Hagstedt for the music, and of course to Radio Free Brooklyn.
Tune in next week, The Womanity Project on Radio Free Brooklyn, every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time.
And we will leave you this afternoon with a song that was given to us by Shivali from last week, if you remember her. She has a show opening today, this evening at the Paradise Factor. So in her honor,
directed by Celine.
Yes. shameless plug, shameless self-promotion. And so we'd like to leave you with that, and we will see you all next week. Au revoir, tout le monde.
À la semaine prochaine. Bye. No, 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 no. Whoa, whoa. No, 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 whoa.
Everything that I see, I want your high love and emotion endlessly. I can't get over you. You left your mark on me. I want your high love and emotion endlessly. 'Cause you're a good girl and you know it. You act so different around me. Tujhe dekha to ye jaana sanam, pyar hota hai deewana sanam.